And now we have a next one. I'm very pleased and I have the pleasure to talk with Robert Hilliard, but actually it's not me talking, it's him talking. And we agreed to the following. Robert will talk about his experience. And then he asked me to ask him difficult questions. So I thought about three difficult questions. And then we'll open, of course, to the audience, because I'm sure you have a lot of questions to him as well. Let me start with briefly saying that Robert Hilliard is not a St. Ottilian baby, but that he is from the other side, which doesn't mean from the dark side, but from the light side as well. American soldier, coming as a journalist for an army newspaper to Bavaria. I think maybe that's enough for my introduction. And Robert, please tell us what happened.
Entschuldigt bitte, dass ich spreche nur ein bisschen Deutsch.
It doesn't work.
Also ich muss in
English. It doesn't work. It doesn't work. It's not open. Not working.
I don't need a mic anyway.
Entschuldigt bitte, dass ich spreche nur ein bisschen Deutsch und ich muss in Englisch sprechen. I'm so pleased to see so many of you here this evening when you could be having such a better time at the Bierstube.
We'll go there afterwards.
And I'm thankful for being invited here, and I am just overwhelmed by the hospitality of the monks at St. Ottilian. And special thanks to Father Cyril, who contacted me. And if some of you saw the documentary film that was made in 2000, you will know that one of the stars of the film is Father Martin. I suppose the easiest thing for me to do is to just tell you how I came to St. Ottilian. I was an American soldier in World War II, and I was wounded, went to the hospital. When I came out of the hospital, they told me, and I was happy to hear this, that, your wounds are too much. We cannot send you back into the battle. But your wounds are not good enough to send you back home. So we are assigning you to an Air Force unit. And actually, some of you may know, it was a big Luftwaffe Flugplatz in Kaufbeuren. And they said, what do you want to do here? Because the war was almost over, a few weeks before it was over. And I had been a reporter, part-time, before I went into the army. I will start a newspaper. All right, you will be editor of our newspaper. And so one day, someone said, Bob, there is a liberation concert taking place at some monastery or something called St. Ottilian. Would make a good story. And I thought, of course. So I got in my Jeep and I drove there and I got the shock of my life. There were people virtually dying in front of my eyes. The concert was set up with a small stage, and it's in back of the old hospital, now the same place. And on the stage were musicians in their concentration camp striped uniforms still. And they were playing music that had been banned for years. And then Dr. Grinberg made a speech. And I hope all of you have read that speech somewhere, in which he told of the horrors that the survivors had gone through. And he told of the horrors they were still going through. He said, we have no food. We have no medicines. We had a difficult time. We finally got these few buildings at St. Etienne for shelter. And people are dying. He was an old man. He was 24. And we decide, what can we do? Well, the first thing we did is ecumenical, because we got soldiers, some Jewish soldiers, Catholic soldiers, Protestant soldiers, atheists, who I told what was going on here. And they said, we want to help. We stole food from our own kitchen and smuggled it in. Now, we didn't feel bad about doing this, because our chief cook was selling the food in the black market anyway. This is a better use of it. So we continued to do that. Now, as you may know, what the American military did and the American military government did was put barbed wire around displaced persons camps, including St. Etienne. Remember, we came one day, American military police said, we don't want you smuggling anything in, no food. Well, we resorted to various ways to get it in, to smuggle it in, and various ways to get food to start with. Edward Herman and I were privates. That's the lowest rank in the Army. Neither one of us was interested in becoming officers, partially because we knew that the war in Europe was going to be over soon, and if we went to officers' school, they would send us to Japan, where there would be further fighting as expected. So we were fine. One of the things that we did with another soldier, Anthony DiBiase from Philadelphia, Catholic family. I think he was an atheist, but his family was Catholic. And he wanted to help. So we borrowed officers' uniforms. Now, we took off the insignia because we didn't want to be accused of impersonating an officer, which would need to be immediately court-martialed. We went to the different burgomeisters, the mayors of the towns in this general area. Now, as you may know, many, if not most of them, were the same burgomeisters, the same mayors, who had been there under Hitler. And I remember asking a colonel once, this doesn't make sense, why are you doing that? We have to have an efficient operation in these cities, and these men know how to do it. That was the reason. Anyway, we put on these uniforms and went to burgomeister officers. And this was when there was no food here. I remember, and maybe some of you older people remember, a wonderful German actor, Erich von Stroheim, who played the epitome of the Prussian general. Well, I would walk in with the 2 years I studied German in gymnasium in America, and I would say, Sie müssen haben hier morgen früh 100 Pfund Kartoffeln. Well, now, if a Nazi Garleiter had walked in and said that weeks before, you know they would have obeyed. And they didn't know we weren't officers. So they thought we could do something. Of course, we couldn't do anything at all. We had no power. But that's another way in which we got food, to say the Tibetan. The third way, which has never been done before or since in the United States military, each base, military base, has what's called a post exchange, or PX. Some of you heard the word. What it is, it's a store in which the soldiers can buy candy, shirts, pants, cigarettes, shaving, lotion, toothpaste, things like that. Our base was about to be moved. And Edward Herman, he was an entrepreneur, a wheeler dealer in American slang. He said, I'm going to go to the colonel and tell him he does not have to move our post exchange. I will buy it. And I said, Ed, nobody ever buys a PX. It's crazy. And he said, I will buy it. And he did. He had made money by, and it was all legal, pseudo-legal. He would arrange to bribe our officers, and he would get an ambulance, and in Germany pick up some of the wonderful German things like binoculars, medical instruments, cameras. And he would go across the border. He had to bribe people at the border at that time because the borders were shut, into France. Sell it in France, and in France pick up perfumes and clothes that they didn't have in Germany, and come back and sell it here. So he made money. By today's standards, not that much money, but he had enough money, and he bought our PX, he bought our post exchange, and we brought it to St. Etienne. And it was a freilich when we got here with those goods. And we gave the people things we thought they could use. For example, handkerchiefs we used for bandages. And clothes, they were all men's clothes, but women could wear men's clothes too, so they had clothes that they didn't have. Shaving lotion, men's shaving lotion, we gave to the women because it was the closest thing they had to perfume in years. And one more thing, and I've teased Edward about it all his life until he died 10 years ago. There were cigarettes that he bought for the PX. Now, some of you may not know that cigarettes was gold. A pack of cigarettes in Germany could buy anything. I mean, literally anything. I got a wonderful Leica camera for a pack of cigarettes. So cigarettes was gold here. Ed could have made a lot of money by selling the cigarettes on the black market. He didn't. He gave them to St. Etienne with everything else because we didn't know then what cigarettes did. And so later years, I would say, the people there weren't dying fast enough, you had to give them cigarettes. Anyway, that went on and months went by. And nothing happened. Some organizations came, JDC, Joint Distribution Committee. They had headquarters in Switzerland. They came, and I was there. They came twice. I was there each time. And I remember the officials said, oh, the poor children, because there were a lot of little children who survived the camps. And there must have been, well, at least a dozen, maybe more, at St. Timothy. Oh, we got to do something for the children. Oh, it's terrible. We got to do something. They went away, did nothing. They came a second time. And again, oh, we will do something. They did nothing. UNRWA, United Nations Rehabilitation Association. They came, looked around and said, oh, you poor people here, we got to do something. They did nothing. And that went on. July came. And although it is warm here, nevertheless, when winter comes, the cold from the Alps does come far enough here so that it gets cold. And we were worried. And people had no clothing. They had the remnants of their concentration camp uniforms. A few people were able to get clothing. For example, as Ada pointed out in her speech, the way that Dr. Grinberg got these outbuildings was from an American officer. After Dr. Grinberg came here, he went into the military commandment. Now, this was a German hospital, and the German army had taken it over. And actually, I saw some German, it seemed mainly for German officers. And I saw them where they were sitting, smoking cigarettes, being served. It was a wonderful hospital for them. And Dr. Grinberg saw there were a few empty buildings. And he went in and he wanted buildings. They practically threw him out. And that day, so he told me, on the road, he had 420 people. An American officer, Captain Otto Raymond from St. Louis in the United States, who happened to be a Catholic, said, what's this? Who are these people? And Dr. Grinberg explained who they were, survivors, and what he wanted to do and get some buildings. And as he told me, Captain Raymond then got him a civilian suit. It was not well fitting. It was, I remember, I think it was a gray suit, but it was a civilian suit. And took him, the next day, took Dr. Grinberg in, and they didn't recognize the same man, of course, and said, he is a Red Cross official. And unless you give us those buildings, the Red Cross will take the entire hospital. So they got the buildings. So a few people from time to time were able to get some civilian clothing, pieces of civilian clothing, but many of them still had them. So when I came to 27th of May, 1945, to a liberation concert, I found a horrible situation. And that's one of the things we tried to do, to bring food in. But it wasn't enough. You know, for a time, 420 people arrived here, 420 survivors. That was the figure Dr. Grinberg gave me. And each week, dozens of new survivors would come because they heard about the hospital. And the figure remained at 420 because dozens would die every week. July 25th, 1945, there was a conference held here. And Dr. Grinberg was a wonderful organizer, held here of representatives of displaced persons camps in British and American zones. Mainly American zone, but include the British zone, and part of the zone in Austria. And they did two things. One, they told of the situations in their various camps. And you may not believe what I'm going to tell you, because I couldn't believe it at the time. For example, in the camp at Wies, Austria, the American military police were in charge of the camp. They had received some food and clothing. They did not distribute it to the survivors in the camp. They shut off all communication so no one could communicate outside the camp. And when the situation got bad enough, I'm talking about the American police, the so-called liberators, the saviors. And what they did, they distributed food and clothing in exchange for the women. There were other camps where survivors had no place to go. And what did the American military do? They wanted a place to live. They put them back in the same concentration camps that they were released from. It's a horrible situation. And Ed Herman and I knew we had to do something. Now, another part, and some of you, particularly if you're living now in Israel, you know that one of the manifestos at that particular conference, which was July 25 and 6 or 7, maybe in 3 days, I think it was just two, was a manifesto for a homeland in what was called Eretz Israel. And that was a base for what then became a push for Israel. Well, Ed Herman and I, what do you do? And I remember saying to Ed, you know, if the American people knew about this, they would do something. And so we decided to write a letter. And I was the writer, because I my field at the time, I'd been a reporter and I loved to write and I'd been doing some writing. And Ed, as an entrepreneur, he was a businessman. He knew what to do to convince people. And so we wrote the letter accusing the American people of continued genocide by neglect. And we listed the kinds of things that were happening, and we said, we need packages. We want you to send 50, 60, 70-pound packages. We arranged with the Protestant chaplain on our base to receive the packages, because we didn't want the packages to go to a soldier, because someone might think, well, going to a soldier, it's going to be sold on the black market. But the Protestant chaplain said, put my name, and that will be fine. Nobody's going to question me. So he put his name on it. And we asked for packages. Food, clothing, medicines, whatever they could send. And Rabbi Klausner, at the time, American military rabbi, he said he gave us some materials, some religious materials, that he wanted included. Actually, at the time, he wanted mainly religious materials, and I remember Ed and I argued with him and said, that's fine, but they've got to survive. Food is most important. But anyway, we got letters back from families and friends. We had various soldiers on the base send out hundreds of letters to churches, synagogues, to family, to friends, to anybody they knew they thought might do something. And then we got letters back, Ed and I. I remember my mother sent a letter saying, I hope you received the package. I went to our local Golden Chain, and they sent a big package, 70-pound package. We received nothing. A month went by and no packages. And we couldn't imagine what was happening. Then there was a series of events. As we found out later, the letter reached President Truman, who was very concerned about the accusations. And he sent Dean Earl Harrison, he was on leave from Dean of the University of Pennsylvania Law School, to investigate. And Dean Harrison was his representative to the international refugee organization in Europe. So he wanted to find out who these two radical, crazy boys making these accusations. One day, Ed and I were in Munich on some other business, and we meet Rabbi Klausner walking with this man. And this man has in his hand a copy of our letter. And Rabbi Klausner introduces us to Dean Harrison. And he looks at us and he says, "Oh, you're the two youngsters who wrote this letter. We're going to do something about it." Well, my first reaction was, I said, "They're going to do something. They're going to court-martial us." And Ed said, "No." And he knew. Well, another thing happened. Shortly after that, I was in my newspaper office, and Ed was not with my newspaper. He was off, I don't know what he was doing, something else. Actually, he was, we were at that point near Oberpfaffenhofen, where there was another, I think there still is an airfield there, a big airfield there. But he was out doing something in the community, probably buying and selling, which is what he did in his lifetime. A colonel, we call them a chicken colonel, that is a full colonel with an eagle on their shoulder, came to my office, and private, being visited by a colonel? I mean, it didn't make sense. And he said, "Where's Private Herman?" I said, "I don't know, but I suspect he'll be back sometime this afternoon." And he says, "General Eisenhower wanted you and Private Herman to know that he appreciates you going beyond your call of duty. And he now knows about the situation and will do something about it. And you don't have to send out any more letters. And besides," and he looked up my record, "because in the Battle of the Bulge, I got frozen feet." And he said, "You know, General Eisenhower appreciates young men like you, and even though the war is over in Japan by that time, we may need men like you up in the Aleutian Islands." That afternoon, he found Ed, and I met up with Ed probably at dinner time at our mess hall, probably about 6 o'clock, and he said, "A full colonel from Eisenhower came to see me," and he repeated exactly, it was exactly the same kind of conversation, except Ed had been making money. And the colonel said to him, "You know, up in the Aleutian Islands, you won't have an opportunity to do the kind of business you're doing here." Well, that night, of course, we sent out more letters. And we realized that if Eisenhower himself had to send a representative to threaten two privates, somebody must be holding our backup. And obviously it was Truman, because eventually, as some of you know, the Harrison Report, and September 30th, 1945, front page headlines in the New York Times and in many other newspapers in the United States, "President orders Eisenhower to end new abuse of Jews, likens our treatment to that of the Nazis." But where's the food? Where are the packages?